Session number 12778, General Peter Martin, Reel 1.
Now, you served in the Cheshire Regiment during the war, and the Cheshire Regiment always had the reputation of being a machine gun battalion. Can you tell me how they worked, please?
Well, two weapons had survived in the army from World War I and were to continue to play an important part in World War II, and they were the Mills hand grenade and the Vickers medium machine gun, the queen of the battlefield in the First World War. The Cheshire Regiment had converted from a normal infantry role shortly before the war to become a mechanized machine gun regiment. The Vickers gun, justly famous for its ability to produce a high rate of sustained and accurate fire, had become even more versatile because of the introduction of the dial sight, similar to the sight used by the Royal Artillery, and the streamlined Mark 8 Z ammunition, which replaced the Mark 7 303 round used by Bren gunners and riflemen. The new ammunition gave the gun a range, an effective range of 4,500 yards. While in the past, the Vickers could always be laid by daylight on a fixed line on which it could then fire by night in front of our own defended localities, the dial sight enabled a whole string of possible defensive fire tasks to be recorded and then fired on call. The dial sight also enabled the Vickers to be used for map shoots and for firing from behind cover, from behind crests, so that the guns couldn't be seen by the enemy, and particularly for use in harassing fire tasks. It's interesting, I was reading a book by Sir David Hunt the other day called Dawn at War, in which he tells how General Stummer, who had just taken over from Rommel at Alamein, accompanied by his chief signal officer, had gone to up to an observation point at Alamein when the chief signal officer was hit and killed by a bullet from a long-range medium machine gun, probably firing a harassing fire task. And the shock of that was so great that Stummer himself then dropped dead with a heart attack. So although very often one never knew the result of harassing fire tasks, the ability to fire at long range onto possible enemy forming up places, supply lines, ration convoys coming up in miles behind the front line, was superb. We never did harassing fire from our operational gun positions, from our battle positions, so it meant that alternative positions had to be constructed elsewhere from which the guns could then be taken out or taken to fire their harassing fire tasks and then go back to their battle positions again. Now, the mechanization also produced new roles. The machine guns could be left behind as rear guards to withdrawing infantry, and in attack they could fire in support of the advancing troops by neutralizing targets to a flank or firing overhead, and still be up in support for the reorganization phase as soon as the objective had been captured. And that really became the principal role towards the second half of the war. The first half we've already dealt with, which was largely withdrawal. But the second half, it was very much a question of supporting an attack by fire and then getting up on the objective as soon as the infantry did to consolidate with them. Now, the main factor in deciding how to sight your guns in defence, apart from their range, was the pattern of bullet strike on the ground, known as the beaten zone. This pattern took the shape of a cone, which was much longer than it was broad, and according to the range, might vary from 100 to 600 yards in length. By sighting guns so that they fired in enfilade across the front of an infantry locality, Fire could be produced very close to our infantry, and it was more effective because the guns producing this fire might well be operating from positions a mile or more away from the localities being attacked, so that the guns themselves might not be under attack themselves. During World War I, the Vickers machine gun was manned by the machine gun corps, but after that war, every infantry battalion had either a platoon or company of machine guns in it. And it follows that practically every senior officer in World War II had had some experience of meeting machine guns. Most of them were pre-dial sight days and tended to want to operate medium machine guns rather in the aerial friend manner of firing over battle sites on a swinging Travis at an advancing enemy about 60 yards away. But that wasn't the best way of using them. And we did, from time to time, have trouble with either battalion commanders or brigade commanders who wanted to operate machine guns in their old way. The machine gun company commanders advised brigade commanders on the best use of the guns in attack and defence, and exercised a great deal of command and control in producing a coordinated company of machine gun fire plan. It was very rare that the machine gun battalion commander had any say in the planning or coordination of fire, except in conditions of prolonged static defence, when a divisional fire plan could produce, or when a joint anti-tank and machine gun screen was formed to guard an exposed flank of the division, such as the occasion I've already mentioned at Metanine. It followed that the machine gun battalion commander was largely limited to administration, reinforcements, resupply, and transport of food and ammunition. The command of a machine gun battalion was not much of an attraction for its commanding officer, who rarely commanded anything other than his own headquarters and headquarter company. And company commanders, who formed fierce attachments to their brigades, did not take lightly to attempts by battalion headquarters to tell them how to do their jobs. Medium machine gun companies became in effect private armies, and only a commanding officer with a very powerful personality could do much to control and influence them.
But the Cheshires, the Northumberlands and the Middlesex were the specialist machine gun battalions.
And the Mensters. And all those regiments had a number of battalions, so that our 6th battalion was in 44 div, our 7th battalion was in 5 div, and so on. And similarly with the Middlesex and the Manchester's Northumberland Fusiliers. We were divisional troops.
Can we pick up your narrative from the other interview, because I think that we were on the brink of the Sicily invasion?
Yes, I think we got to the stage where the battalion was sent back to Sidi Bish at Alexandria to prepare for the next operation, whatever it might be. Now, I have found a diary, which for some reason or another I kept, for about a fortnight in May 1943, and from it I see that I and another officer, David Cox, who had been a platoon commander with me in B Company, were sent back by the commanding officer ahead of the battalion to attend a course at the Combined Training Centre at Cabrit in the Canal Zone to learn all about assault crossings on beaches. And the idea was that we should then train the battalion in how to do an assault beach crossing. My diary, in fact, starts on Wednesday the 5th of May. The battalion itself didn't get to Sidi Bish until the 11th of May, but we started on the 5th of May, and we've been told by the commanding officer that if we had to report to the Combined Training Centre, Cabrit, on Sunday the 9th of May, but if we can get to Alexandria quicker than that, then we can have them leave before starting. So we shot off, and on Wednesday the 5th of May, started at 9:15 after a wonderful bathe, reached Alexandria by 11 a.m., straight to the Hotel Cecil, where we get a double room which takes away our breath with its luxury. And then it relates over the next few days how we fed at the Union Bar, had a Prestrudis, which was always a great popular favourite restaurant. How disappointed we were to find that there were food restrictions since we'd last been at Prestrudis. Thursday the 6th, scrambled eggs and coffee in bed at 8:45 hours. Red papers in bed, what luxury. And I do remember how wonderful it was to have a shower and get all the sand out of one's hair. And we spent the next two or three days doing that. On Saturday the 8th of May, I see it says, got news of fall of Tunis and Bizerta, streets decorated with flags. Eventually, on Sunday the 9th, we went down to Cabrit and were given accommodation, and the course started on the Monday. And I'm afraid that my comments on the course are typical of an arrogant young officer who thought he knew everything after a brief spell in the desert. I make various caustic comments. Morning spent in introductions, impressed by DCO, whatever that was, an amusing admiral. Also demonstration of various sorts of craft. Tuesday, strenuous but interesting morning of lectures and discussions. After another lecture, we had a talk about the Dieppe raid, which confirmed a lot of my previous opinions and shattered others. I remember being how horrified one was to learn of all the disasters which had taken place in that raid. Wednesday morning of lectures and Royal Engineer demonstrations. Thursday, a monotonous morning of lectures followed by an afternoon at the cinema, where we saw the security film Next of Kin. Really very good, but too many dugouts in it to be realistic. In the evening we were divided into syndicates to discuss an operation. The head of our syndicate was an aged lieutenant colonel, that probably means he was about 40, destined as second in command of a battalion. Heaven help it. Friday we watched a demonstration by the Dorsets. Quite good, but not much use for practical warfare. Proceedings were enlivened by the presence of 30 Corps Commander General Lees, who didn't seem to think much of things. Remainder of day on exercise incredible. Saturday course over except a lecture by Brigadier McCandlish on manpower. Very interesting. And so we got back to the battalion, and there was a rumour while we were on the course that the commanding officer, Colonel Marco Keeling, who had commanded the battalion since Alamein, had gone, but he hadn't. He had instead been awarded the DSO in recognition of what the battalion had done at Marith and Mori Akarit. And this was slightly ironic, because Marco Keeling made it very clear, as soon as he took over command, that he did not intend to put anybody in for decorations for doing their job. It was the duty of every officer to behave gallantly under fire. and to carry out his orders. And no one should get a medal for doing that. And that was, I think that was fine by us, but when one saw every infantry officer who went out on a patrol getting an MC almost automatically, it did make us feel a bit sick at times. And in fact, I have gone through the lists of medals awarded to various battalions of the regiment during the whole of the Second World War too, and we have about a quarter of any other battalion, although we saw more service than any. So that was interesting. In fact, much later in the war, in the sort of period after Normandy, Tony Mellor, who I mentioned before, who was still commanding B Company, and myself, we went to our respective brigade commanders and asked whether we might have permission to put in recommendations ourselves through the brigade list, because Marco was not prepared to put people in through the battalion list. And that way I managed to get about six, I think, MMs during the rest of the war. But that I just mentioned that because, in fact, I remember after the war in about 1951 at the Staff College, this was the subject of discussion, whether medals were something which should be awarded or not. And I think the general feeling that time was that if anybody deserved a Victoria Cross, he certainly ought to get it. But otherwise, battles were won by the soldiers as a team, and it'd be much better if a battalion was awarded a distinction of some sort, just in the same way that in World War One, various battalions were awarded the Croix de Guerre and wore the ribbon of the Croix de Guerre on their shoulders. During that time at Sidi Bish, I had another 4 days leave in Cairo, which was fun. And then we had our study period. I remember going out and buying tin soldiers and tin tanks and so on for our cloth model, which we painted. And David Cox and I gave lectures to all the officers and senior NCOs on how assault landings on enemy-occupied beaches were carried out, all about beach masters and beach bricks and all the various signs which the landing craft used to direct themselves onto the correct landing point on the beach, and all about the various landing craft, the landing ships, infantry, the landing craft tanks, and in those days we had LCMs, landing craft for motor transport, and LCPs, which were landing craft personnel, as well as the LCAs, which were the assault landing craft.
What's a beach brick?
A beach brick was normally a battalion which was specially trained to take stores and things across the beach from landing craft and to run ammunition depots and so on from the beach area and to process reinforcements coming through the beaches and so on. On June the 4th we moved down from Sidi Bish to Attica, which is near Suez, and there we were in a tented camp just below a steep escarpment which runs up onto the hills by Attica. And there we trained like fury. We had been told that wherever we were going, and we didn't at that stage know where, we would have very little transport. And therefore, the machine guns and their equipment and their ammunition would usually have to be carried on the man's back. So we experimented with methods of carrying as much ammunition as possible. The ammunition, so Vickers machine gun, as I said, the Mark 8 said ammunition, which was in belts of 250 rounds, each belt being in a tin liner, as it was called, and there were two liners in a box of ammunition. And we worked up so that the gun teams, with the number one on the gun, who was the person who fired the trigger, he carried the tripod, which weighed 50 pounds, but the number two, who was the person who fed the ammunition into the gun, carried the gun, and that was something like 42 pounds in weight. And number three carried what was called a condenser can, which was a 2-gallon can of water, which, because the gun was water-cooled, and that was about another 23 pounds, I think. And then the other gun numbers had to carry the ammunition. And we worked up methods of carrying 12 belts of ammunition per gun, which was quite a big load. But since the gun could fire 500 rounds in a minute, which is two belts in a minute, if it was really pressed, that obviously wasn't going to last very long. So ammunition was clearly going to be a problem wherever we were going. But we got extremely fit carrying these very heavy loads up and down the hills around Attica. On the 22nd of June, the divisional operation order arrived for the commanding officer. And there was one hut in the camp, which was a briefing hut. Now, in that hut was set out a cloth model of the area which we were to assault, and the names of the various main features were put on cards which were put on the model. And the company commanders, in turn, went in and were briefed by the commanding officer on their job. And every night there had to be an officer sleeping in this hut to make sure there was no breach of security. Well, one morning, David Cox, who I mentioned before, came to see me. His voice, face as white as a sheet. Long before the Alamein battle, he had told me of a very vivid dream he'd had of being killed at a place called Catania. And he was really shaken. And I said, well, you've obviously been listening to the radio in which there are constant talks about the RAF bombing the enemy airfields at Catania and Sicily. So you've got it in your mind. He said, no, I'm absolutely crystal clear I was going to be killed at Catania. And he said, on the model in the ops room, Catania is one of my objectives. And he really was shaken. Now, he was a splendid chap, David Cox. He'd been at Clifton College. He had been captain of the running eight. He'd got a scholarship to Oxford and had done 1 year at Oxford before being called up. And he was not the sort of person who panicked. He was an extremely brave officer. But he was very, very shaken by this. On the 24th, we all had, all the officers in 52 were given a lecture by Monty. No detail given, but all the usual sort of thing about hitting the enemy at six and that sort of thing. And the following day, he in fact came round our camp and distributed cigarettes in his usual way.
To the men or the officers?
To the men. On the 29th of June, my company and our C company and the commanding officer embarked at Suez on the Dutch motor vessel Royce, R-U-Y-S, and the remainder of the battalion embarked on the Christian Huygens. The Royce was a luxury and fairly new Dutch cruise liner, and it had its full complement of Indonesian staff. He used to go around tinkling their gongs for meals. A lovely dining room with super food. And we sailed the following day along the canal up to Port Said. And here we met up with various other ships of the divisional convoy, which were already up there. And it gave us, I must say, it worried us considerably that all these ships lying in Port Said were such a wonderful target for any enemy aircraft. But nothing came. And we stayed in Port Said until the 5th of July. During that time, I remember the battalion intelligence officer had to sort 8,000 maps ready for distribution after sailing. General Kirkman came and visited every ship and gave an address. Again, expecting every man to do his duty and so on. And on the 5th of July in the morning, the convoy sailed. And as soon as it had sailed, briefing was allowed to start. And we had a great briefing room on the ship with models, air photographs, and in due course we were allowed to brief all our soldiers in this briefing room. And I remember the gasp of amazement when I told them that we were going to Sicily, because I think everybody had been under the impression we were either going to Crete or Sardinia, another favourite, or more probably Greece. So Sicily was a real surprise. And not only did we have splendid aerial photographs and oblique photographs that showed you what the shore would look like as the boat came in, but we had booklets for every soldier, Soldier's Guide to Italy and things like that, with local customs and useful phrases and so on, which every soldier was expected to study before we got to land. Sometime, I think, on the 7th, 2 days after sailing, there was an air raid warning, an unidentified enemy aircraft passed vaguely overhead, but we just hoped that our course at that particular time gave no particular clue as to where we were going. On the 9th of July, we met up with other convoys, and including the transport convoy with our transport on board, which had sailed from elsewhere. I can't remember where they came from. And so that we had one enormous convoy now all assembled together. And at this stage, the weather, which had been blissfully calm,